Ed Barnhart, it's amazing to see you in a dynamic and interactive format. I've watched now about 60 or 70 of your lectures on the Great Courses series. Thank you for that, and welcome.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
All right. So, you're a Mayanist.
Among other things, yes.
That's kind of how you start at UTI. And you've been down there and you've measured pyramids. You're a surveyor.
That's the bulk of the work that I've done down there in the field. I am a mapper and explorer. And yes, surveys, the technique we use to get it out of the jungle.
Yeah, I'm amazed by this. I love surveying. And I've got my own little archaeological project, those rocks on my friend's land. And it seems to me the first thing to start to do, that we'll get in, maybe we'll talk about that, but the measuring of what directions things point and how far apart they are, love it. Okay, so, but since I've got you, can we talk about 2012?
Absolutely.
So this always struck me as being kind of freaky. And I never really trusted all the predictions these panels were making. There were just endless panels and books coming out, and then the movie came out. And I have been, you know, acclimated to the Mayan day count for many years. And my first astrology teacher was a pretty good day keeper. And this all seemed like, what are these people on about? How are they surmising all of this? And to me, the day count and the Tolkien seem sublime, beautiful, not like there's going to be a tidal wave on day 144,000 of 13. No, it seems so sublime, I guess is the only word I can think of. What was your whole take on, like, and you lived through it in slow motion, 2012. What did you think of all these gringos on panels?
Well, you know, in the most positive regard, I was happy to see the entire world all of a sudden recognizing that the Maya exist. I think as a enlightenment, it was great that people were all of a sudden paying attention to a culture that's been, you know, basically under attack for 500 years.
Yes, genocide, so even
I was
in the 50s.
About that.
Yep.
You know, as far as the spin about the Maya calendar predicting the end, I mean, from the very beginning, I thought, well, that's not even how Maya see time. I mean, that's just, they would never do that. They see things as, you know, as cyclical. There's lots of Maya wisdom that talks about what has happened in the past will happen again. And it's not like a record on repeat. It's more like I envision it kind of like a spring where it does go in the same cycles, but they're not exactly the same thing that happens. Each turn is slightly different, but in the same shape, I guess. So, you know, there was also the fact that, as you say, there are these cycles of Maya time, the Tolkien and the Hob, which are the way they see things. The long count was made well after those two calendars, and it is more of a linear view of time. So it can go far into the future and far into the past. And really, I mean, mathematically, it's not a cycle. It's a continuous thing that has some cycles within it, a lot like the way we count our years. You know, it's 2021 this year, and that's 2021 years since a zero point that we, you know, arbitrarily picked sometime in the past. But it's, you know, it's got cycles within it, but overall it's a linear count of days. That linear count of days is what people latched onto. And really the Maya stopped paying attention to that at contact. I mean, the modern Maya people don't pay attention to the long count, and 2012 meant nothing to them. It's the Tolkien and the Hob that really mean something to them and tell them about how to live and who they are.
Contemporary Maya don't pay attention to the long count. No. And they like the Tolkien, which is much more, the Hob is the civil calendar. Yes.
Right. It's the solar calendar. Yeah.
With 365
days.
65 days, but no leap years. So they've got a little thing going on.
It drifted. And, you know, there's a lot of things we don't understand about why they made these calendars. The long count is really weird that its year is 360 days. So it's losing 5 days of the solar count every year. It's completely worthless to a farmer. They can't use that to farm at all.
What amazed me about, and I don't know if this is some contrivance, but what amazed me about 12/21/12 is that it lands on the winter solstice and it lands in the year of transit of Venus.
Yes.
Well, given losing 5 days a year and all that stuff notwithstanding, that's pretty damn good.
It is fascinating. I mean, there are ways to pick apart the long count calendar where you can see the foundations of it are very planetary. There's their Venus and its relationship with the Earth seem to be at the core of the math. And I don't want to make, you know, people's eyes spin back in their head trying to explain it all, but there's an interesting correlation between Earth and Venus that the Maya picked up on, so did the Babylonians, but almost no other culture early on, which is that there's a 5-to-8 ratio between the two. If you watch Venus forever, you notice that on average, it comes back to the same place in the sky 584 days later. It's really 583.92 if you do it, but the Maya had it at 584. And then the sun is, of course, 365, actually 365.2422, which the Maya actually had some way to calculate, it seems. But those two together, strangely, 8 counts of the sun is exactly 5 counts of Venus. So there's this 5-to-8 ratio. And that seems to be a bit of the foundation of that long count calendar. So it doesn't surprise me that it hits certain things along the way, especially on the Bakhtuns. The trick is not every Bakhtun hits so neatly. It was neat that the 13th did. The question is, did they plan that 2,000 years earlier?
Yeah, I've pondered this. And, perhaps my beginner's mind, but I would think, okay, the year of a transit of Venus, that's cool. The year, the day of a solstice, that, but to have it both, that's a pretty good coincidence. By the way, here's a mandala of the orbit of Venus, the middle one there. That's what it looks like.
Huh. I've never seen that. That's kind of cool.
So I can refer you to this book. And so we have an astrology audience. So there's going to be some wonks who think this is interesting. And, so on.
Well, good.
So the concept that there was some profound transformation, cataclysm, the end of time and all this stuff, this has Western intellectual roots, basically, that start in a 1973 book, I think you said.
I may have that date a little off. I think actually it was the early 60s that particular, it's basically a textbook called The Maya. And at the time, the author was Michael Coe, and he wrote, he's kind of got a wry sense of humor, and he decided to write that if the Maya calendar reset to zero at this distant past point with that the Maya clearly tell us about, it correlates to the year 3114 BC, specifically on August 13th. That if it reset then, that it would reset again, like the odometer of your car. And that went up the when it arrived to the completion of 13 Bakhtuns or 400 year periods, it reset to day one again. So if you did the math, you'd come up with 2012, December 21st. And so Coe, an archaeologist, was the first to put that in a book and flippantly said, well, I guess the world restarts again. And that really started people picking up that ball and running with it in all sorts of directions.
Right. Like Jose Arguelles, for example.
Oh, yes. Very popular book. More popular than any archaeology book ever.
And then Terrence McKenna picks up on it, and or they around the same time. Who knows if they were talking? And
oh, I think they were.
And then it's conspiracy theory. And then and then there's all this. I think absolutely. I watched it all thinking this is ridiculous. I mean, I'm a scholarly person, and I've been sifting through spiritual bullshit and spiritual truths since, you know, I could hold a book, and thinking, come on, guys. Come on, guys. Good. So I'm gathering that you were a bit skeptical and taking a kind of a counterpoint. You were kind of saying like the what you're saying now, that like what's the big whoop? Basically.
Well, you know, I mean, I see both sides of it. There is a, you know, I look at the calendar very scientifically and mathematically and look at how it functions. And I've made, you know, computer programs that run it and show me all these things. And I'm always looking for hidden, you know, planetary conjunctions and things within it that they might have been the reason they were using it and made this complex system. And we do have a really nettling issue that the Maya have a creation story called the Popol Vuh. And in the Popol Vuh, it's very clear that we, or the Maya, I should say, were people of the fifth creation, and that there were four creations before us. And they all actually ended rather cataclysmically. And so there's reason to believe that if we're in the fifth creation, that at some point it will end, and probably cataclysmically. So then you apply the Maya calendar to this, and the Maya hieroglyphics are also very clear that at the end of the fourth creation, they tell us the date, and they tell us that it's the end of the 12th Bakhtun, or the number 12 Bakhtun. It's technically the 13th, just like our centuries go. But when it arrives to 13 Bakhtuns, instead of just going to 13 Bakhtuns in one day, it resets to 0001. So that's the opening. And it tells us that when 13 400 year periods of the fourth creation ended, that the fifth creation began. So you see where, you know, mathematically one would say, well, if this is a, if we use our car odometer theory, that it should reset again when it reaches 13, and we'll be in the sixth Bakhtun. Okay. And based on what the Maya said happened in the other Khatuns, there was, or Bakhtuns, or creations, sorry, there's reason to believe that there was something cataclysmic that was going to happen.
Right. And on a very long cycle, the thing cataclysmic does not necessarily happen on that day. It may happen in succession of that day. It's not a one-day event. There are all kinds of cataclysms going on right now that are outside of our topic area. But we could say transhumanism is one of them. We've certainly entered a transhumanist period of history post in the years surrounding 2012. By that, I mean the 20, 30 years surrounding even longer, the 60s, surrounding 2012, you know, the type of technology that we're living with is getting a certain result. So we may not have seen the, assuming a sixth creation and a cataclysmic end of the of 13, well, it may not be Christmas Day of 2012. That's not what we're talking about. Right. Even
well, and the question of whether the Maya thought that it was going to reset anywhere near here is the one that I really bring up. That number one, the Maya don't tell us how long the other four creations were.
Yes.
They don't say at all. They don't say that they were all 13 Bakhtuns. And if we go to their neighbors, the Aztec, who also believe in multiple creations, they actually specified how long each creation was, and it was not the same every time.
Yep.
One of them's 312 years, two of them are 676 years, which is all ridiculously small compared to what the Maya were talking about. But the thought that the Aztecs were comfortable that each creation had its a different time length calls into question that just because the fourth creation was 13 baktuns, that this fifth creation would be.
Right. Again, an assumption. And it's, yes. And the, also we are, we're dealing with, I guess what's not strictly science. At a certain point, these creations, the source of that information is priestly in a way. It's not necessarily, look, I mean, we have enough time knowing what happened last week, right? We don't, there's debates over what happened on January 5th or 6th, right? And all kinds of stories get piled up on it, whatever day that was during the insurrection. All kinds of stories get piled onto these things. And when we don't have these people to interview to sort them out, I'm impressed that people can be looking at things on the walls of paintings and in codexes and actually getting something. But as you said so eloquently, and I was looking for language to describe that, archaeology is a method, not a science. It's a method.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very unpopular opinion in my field.
Well, I say the same thing. Right in my terms of service, I say astrology is not the truth. It's a form of personally applicable fiction. Yeah, it's based on a scientific device. This whole thing is based on the U.S. Navy's ephemeris. That's that much is scientific. What it means is much more poetic, and the world we're always imposing our worldview on what we dig up, essentially.
Oh, and it takes, that's for sure.
And I see you questioning that a lot. You know, I've now watched 60 of your lectures, like most people know me through my presentations, and you're always saying, well, but maybe that's only true as far as it goes. Maybe that's not. That's not quite it. So let's briefly talk about your calendar. You do a calendar. I want to blatantly recommend that we have a live person here who can explain what he's done. And you've devoted your life to this and largely, I mean, you've done many things, but your PhD is in Mayan studies and you have your own calendar.
I do. Thanks for bringing it up. I actually inherited it from another guy, but it's a way to keep the ancient Maya calendar alive. It's, you know, me and another 7,000 day keepers in Guatemala are doing so. But in the United States, a lot of people, you know, are interested in it, but they don't know exactly how it works. So I make this annual calendar that is, you know, the Christian 12-month calendar, but in each one of the day blocks, it also tells you what day it is in the Maya calendar.
In the Tzolk'in and the long count or the hob?
The Tzolk'in, the hob, and the long count. Because mm-hmm. those are the three that the Maya in the classic period were really looking at. Nowadays, modern Maya almost always look at the Tzolk'in, and then they pay attention to the hob a little bit just because there are 5 days at the end of every year that are called the Wayeb. And they're kind of dangerous, unpredictable days where it's better to just do nothing. Just
at the end of the 260. At the end of the
365. And they link into the Tzolk'in. The two in the idea of Mesoamerica are intertwined.
The hob and the Tzolk'in.
Yeah. Let's say, you know, my calendar explains this a little bit in the first prefaces. The calendar is really just to keep this, you know, this calendar alive and to let people see a different rhythm of time, which I think your audience is particularly interested in. But the very first calendar that was made in Mesoamerica, which we're not sure the Maya or the Olmec made it. We're not sure still. Archaeology's vote is out. But it was the 260-day sacred calendar. And as far as we can tell, it had nothing to do with astronomy or astrology.
Mm-hmm.
260 days is the gestation period of a human life. It's 9 months. So they made a cycle that was particular to us. Then at some point, hundreds of years later, they said, well, you know, we also want to look at the solar calendar for agricultural purposes and maybe something else. But they already had this calendar set up, this 261. So in their thinking of how time was already recorded, they simply brought it out another 105 days. There's a lot of, except for the Maya, every other culture in Mesoamerica that uses 360 or 260, I'm sorry, lots of numbers here. They just bring it out another 105 days to equal 365. And whatever day that hits in the Solkine calendar is what's called the year bearer. And that's the year. Like the Aztecs will tell us it is the day of the Solkine. And then in the year, this year bearer, which is also a one of four things of the Solkine. If you take 20 day names and you run them out for 105 more days, that five, you know, 20 of them go into 100 evenly, and then there's a five remainder. And when that five remainder runs, it hits one of four of the 20 days repeatedly. So it's for the Aztec, it's house, rabbit, reed, flint. And so it'll go one house, two rabbit, three reed, four flint, one, five house, and so on through 52 years. That's where they play this multiple, the lowest common multiple, highest common divisor kind of game that they love to play numerologically. 260 days and 365 days link up and match at 52 years or solar periods. So they go 52 years. That's how the two calendars are linked together.
Very interesting. So
every other culture other than the Maya just did that. They didn't make, the Maya made a hob calendar with months.
Got it. So mostly. So I was going to go somewhere with this. I think the calendar that most people are interested in is the Solkine, which is there's a 20-day phase and a 13-day phase. No, there's a 13 symbols and 20 symbols.
13 numbers and 20 day names. So those two, there's no weeks, there's no months. When you combine 13 times 20, you get 260. So you have 260 unique day names.
Combinations. Combination of a number and a name.
Right.
Okay. And
the coefficient in the glyph.
Yeah. So let's say, so this is the one that I think most people are interested in. It is interesting.
Certainly the Maya are most interested in it. If the Maya use it as a way to understand who they are and what to do on any given day.
Yes. Cause it defines it describes the quality of the day. One question I have is, let's say I'm born, you know, a certain day, how, a number, I forget what mine is, incredibly, and you don't know your rising sign. We'll solve that soon enough.
We'll have an exchange.
We will. How often does my birthday come up? My particular, let's say I'm 9 eek or 8 eek.
Every 260 days. That's why if your mom got pregnant on 9 eek, she'd expect you to come out on 9 eek.
Ah, okay. Fantastic. All right. So this is what so most of our contact with the concept of the Mayans is, it seems to be, this calendar, the long count, which was not a high priority for them. And then these pyramids that are down there. So we're going to do first 20 people who make any monthly donation to Planet Waves FM, get one of Ed's calendars, just get that ball rolling. So I'll place that order a little later today, and we'll mail them out. So any monthly, $1 a month, $1,000 a month, whatever, we'll send you one. And they're beautiful. The photos, you took these photos, right?
Actually, it's a photo contest. I used to do all the photos myself, but then I thought it would be a fun way to involve my community. So I do a photo contest every year, and they're all from amateur photographers that have went down there.
So you're the photo editor.
I am.
And you can verify that it's not like Zakara or something like that.
Nope. I vet each one of them.
Right. You line it up with the Wikipedia. So there you go. That's that. And then I'm going to pitch your calendar because I've been aching for some connection to the Mayan day count for a long time. The people I originally was working with when 2012 ended, they all disappeared. So, and I'm glad I was not one of those people making all kinds of predictions for 12/21/12 because they were pretty much either wrong or off in the spirit of what they were. It was just not. It was a mess. So I'm glad that's all over, and now we can reflect and look back on it a little bit. And
you know, I also have my Maya calendar app, which that one's fun because anybody can use it to calculate their Maya birthday, and it will tell you when you were born, what your personality and destiny are. You can also give it to friends. It's an easy way to calculate it. It's called Maya, not Mayan, but Maya calendar. And it's made by me, Ed Barnhart. It's only on iPhone now, but if enough people buy it, I'll make an Android version
too. So I can link to that and people can download that, and it's a couple of bucks. How much is it?
99 cents, I think.
Yeah. For the app?
For the app.
Really?
Yep.
That's a bargain.
And it's fun. I took a lot of time to look at only Maya sources to create that information. So it's not about dream spell or anything else like yes. that. It is purely what the Maya think. I've had the interesting pleasure in my life to meet a number of day keepers and have very honest and cool conversations with them about it. So I am certain it is what modern Maya people believe.
This is what I love about your work. And there you go. So hence I'm recommending this and let's have some fun. And now I will get my chance to actually learn this. I want to find a good workbook for it. Maybe if there isn't one, we can make one. Awesome. So that's that. South America.
Okay.
I heard you say, so I watched 50 of your lectures and then you said, oh, by the way, I have 100. So then in great course, worth getting great courses. This is one of the greatest things ever put into video, by the way. I got a professor for everything in my life. And I've watched 100 physics lectures, the bubonic plague series, that's worth watching. Then I discovered your stuff at some point over the summer. And then you said, well, I have 100. And then South America came up on the log algorithm. And you began that by saying, well, I was really, you know, reading books about South America during lunch in the fourth grade. And one of your awesome wisecracks, wow, there's a South America. So that was your thing. And they really didn't have, it's kind of like the way Africa was when we were kids. It said unexplored on the map, like in Mad Magazine. Remember that? And they pull yes. down the map and it just says unexplored or better, the USSR. You know, it's like 60 countries, but they just put USSR and the whole thing is colored red. Well, that's kind of like South America. It has not been explored like Central America or Egypt or anything like that. And I'm gathering that's your passion. And this is fucking fascinating. This series is fascinating. I watched the Mummy one last night with the people in
mummies
being brought out and to be at the party. They keep them in the living room. They don't bury their ancestors. They just keep them around. I mean, so can you tell us a bit about this? And I am gobsmacked. I mean, it's all I can do to not hitchhike to South America tomorrow. But can you introduce us to the topic a little bit?
Absolutely. You know, you're right. There has been a lot of archaeology done there, and we don't want to, you know, dishonor the hard work that Peruvian archaeologists and other folks have done, but it's a pretty, inhospitable place to be doing archaeology between, you know, a lot of what we haven't found is in the high Andes and in the Amazon jungle. And both of those are really, really difficult to get around in.
Yes.
So it's a perfect place to hide entire civilizations.
Even Guatemala, there's entire.
Oh yeah. The Petén is barely cities. Explored. It's yeah. crazy. There's still,
and that's
there's
a little easier
cities out there. But, you know, in terms of South America, if people do know something about ancient South America, it's almost always the Inca. And the Inca were a fantastic society. I mean, at their peak, they were well over 10 million people, and not one person went hungry in their entire empire. It was an amazing achievement of civilization. But it was also the culmination of 5,000 years of cultures that led up to what the Inca were able to do. And that's what people don't really realize about South America, how deep its history is.
Yes. Yeah, it seems to go, it seems like everything that happened happened in South America, even though they obviously were not getting FedEx packages from Cairo with blueprints for pyramids. They may have been first, at least among the people we know about, to have pyramids.
They do seem to be, and certainly by a large stretch, mummies. The Chinchero mummies are thousands of years older than anything in Egypt or China. And it's also, as you were saying, you know, they're so isolated from certainly anything in what, you know, I refer to as the old world, you know, China and Europe and Africa. But it's so old. When they're so isolated like that, when somebody figured out how to build a house, that was an invention.
Yes.
In South America. It was not an adaptation from another culture who showed them. When they learned to weave, that was an invention. When they learned how to make their amazing quipu, that was an invention. They were isolated enough where everything that they came up with was independently discovered, which really gives me, it gets my mind turning about, you know, theories of human parallel development.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we oftentimes misalign that, you know, Star Trek used it to, you know, suggest that, you know, America and capitalism is the best thing in the universe. But there is really, I think, something to be said about a concept of human parallel development, that even in isolation, our ideas build upon each other in, you know, fairly uniform ways, which is fascinating to look at a culture like that and know what they did in isolation from these other ones that we Westerners counted as our ancestors. It's a lesson about how we're all really the same.
I mean, Jung's collective unconscious keeps coming to mind as I'm watching the South America series in particular, that symbols arise, and Jung had the case of the psych patient who had the vision of the waving penis that makes the wind. And this patient, Jung was certain, had no possible way to have read the text in ancient Iranian or Persian mythology that had exactly that symbol. And that was one of the things that led to his discovery of the collective unconscious, that there is a level, there's another plane of reality. And all these folks that you like to go hang out with and measure their shit, they're all on this wavelength. There's other planes of reality. We exist on one of those, if they're vertical or whatever you want to think of them. I think of them as being almost like an alignment that's like pivots by like 1 degree, and suddenly we're in another reality. Or there's a whole gaming dimension of the internet going on in parallel to our conversation. And there's a whole lot of people who all they do on the internet is game. And people like us don't think about that. But it's right next to us. It's right in the world next to us.
And it's invisible, which gets me. I mean, right now in this modern world, I mean, if you could turn on right now a light that would show you all the cell phone signals and cable signals and radio signals that are passing in front and around us, it would be a ball of yarn.
And yeah, so I mean, I'm in the country.
If all that happens invisibly and we made it, Is nature also making such things?
Yeah.
Because we're part of nature. If we can do it, they can do it.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think that all of our internet and digital communication technology is only a metaphor for what really existed long, long ago and still exists in truth. And so this concept of a pyramid was around for a long time before the Giza Plateau, before they started building them on the Giza Plateau.
I do, you know, I'll be a wet rag scientist, logical person, and give you my boring reason for pyramids all over the world, if you'd allow.
Yeah, give me the most dull, uninteresting.
It's really
reason
you can come up with. It's not cool, but it's the truth, or it's not the truth. It's my idea. It's my conception of it. You know, if you're a kid with a bunch of blocks and you want to create something tall, you make a couple of towers and they fall over, and then you figure out, without gluing these together, make a fat base and go to a skinny top, and that will stand up. And that, I think they just wanted to make really tall stuff all over the world, and they figured out that a pyramid is pretty stable like that.
Yep. Yes. Boring, I mean, I saw a Saqqara.
But logical.
Made of. No, it's true. But, you know, I mean, the one at Saqqara, I've been to Egypt. I have not been south. I'm pulled north and you're pulled south. At Saqqara, this thing is made out of bales of hay and mud, and it's still standing there. Bales of hay and mud.
I've been
and
there.
It's like,
that's amazing.
4,000 years old. Did you, off topic, did you experience the sound healing chambers in that place where there's a booth, like a dark room? And you walk through the booth. It's like a stone thing. And you go in just like in a dark room. And there's a block, the stone wall. And there's a opening in the stone wall, which is a space about maybe 2 feet wide and about 2 feet deep. And you stick your head in.
No, I didn't see that. I walked through some long chamber with like what were like closets on either side.
Those
were
the closets.
And then out into the pyramid. Okay, it was in one of those closets.
So in those closets, so we were lucky we had a good corrupt tour guide who could bribe everyone to get us into everything we needed to get into. And so I got to do this and stuck my head in that thing. And I heard a sound I have never heard before and could not replicate. It was two or three tones at once. There was nothing to make a sound. And the reason for the dark room thing was so it could be silent in there. And they were said to be sound healing temples. And it was the sensation was sticking my head out a window in the universe.
Huh.
And the sound happens.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Saqqara created by Imhotep, who was also a medical practitioner? I could be
I don't know
driving
that,
out
but
of
it
my
would
lane
make
there.
Sense
but
if
I think
all
he was,
those
he,
closets.
He was kind of a Renaissance man who understood architecture, but also he was grounded in medical science. So, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised mm-hmm. if Imhotep's place had a had mm-hmm. a sound healing concept. I mean, he was, I think he was one of the most dynamic people in world history.
Interesting. Okay, so let's go back to South America. We briefly visited Egypt for a second. Maybe we'll come back to that someday. You mentioned the fanged god.
The Fang deity, yes, I'm
a Fang deity
with him.
Who is who moves, who's far and wide down there. The feeling I keep getting is, and I know this is unprovable by science and may not be provable by method. This seems to be a real entity. This is not just a comic book. This is not Batman.
This seems especially to the people that worshipped him for thousands of years, I think he was quite real. I mean, you know, if we're going to question the existence of the Fang deity, we should also simultaneously question the existence of God. That's
that's
equivalent.
That's there. It's difficult to describe, and there's a lot of clouding putting on that. But this creature is given a face, and he appears many, many places. Now, obviously, they had time to bring their artwork around and all of this stuff. But they're also using a lot of psychotropic drugs, or maybe not entheogenic drugs, to access the astral and meet entities. Mescalito comes to mind from the, I understand, apocryphal works of Castaneda, but
they're pretty legit.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah, well, there's a discussion. There's a discussion.
He became, you know, a fantastic showman, but I mean, the core of what he was talking about is very, very real to millions and millions of people.
Yeah. You know, whether it's based on an actual person or a composite of teachers and so forth, I find it's valuable information. But anyway, they're using entheogenics to access an astral plane, and you meet spirits there. You will meet entities on the astral when you go hang out there. And some of them are not very friendly, and some of them are friendlier, and they have a life of their own.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this concept of the other world, I mean, you know,
the other, right.
Christianity has its thumb on the world, and it's varying. Yes. You know, it always amuses me how similar Christianity, Islam, and Judaism really are. I mean, they all share the same book at the start. But those collectively, you know, they drive the idea about, you know, the world beyond. But all of North America, all of the Americas believed in this other world where there were spirits to be contacted. When you go to sleep, you go to that world. When you take drugs, you go to that world. And it's a, you know, it's a near-death state. I think that they were, you know, we kind of see them as taking, you know, taking drugs is what we'll say today, but I think they were very well cognizant that they were putting themselves in a near-death state, and that's how they were able to travel to that other plane and meet these spirits.
Yes.
And those spirits get, you know, mixed up through the Western eyes to talk about a pantheon of gods, but really I think there was one deity in South America, the Fang deity, or Ayapec, or Viracocha, whatever you want to call him. But the fascinating thing is that he's a jaguar. So he came from the Amazon. All these big cultures we know of are all up in the Andes and down on the coast. But that guy crawled out of the Amazon. There's a lot to be found there that we don't understand yet, including the foundations of their religion.
Right. So that's, in a sense, maybe their holy land, or the kind of a source, like we, you know, we have these desert religions that, you know, come out of Galilee and the Dead Sea and all that stuff.
By the way, I'm starting to feel, if just for your listeners, if they're interested in this topic of the Fang deity, I do a free podcast called Archeo Ed. And my last two episodes were about the Fang deity. The first one's just the Fang deity, and then it's specifically what the Moche culture thought of him. So there's an hour worth of me talking specifically about that topic for free out there on the interwebs.
Good, happy to link to that when we pull together your page here. So what are the properties of this Fanged deity?
Well, you know, properties in terms of, you know, iconography and art history, he has very, you know, when they're portraying him, he's got very specific qualities. He's got goggle eyes. He's got fanged teeth. That's where the Fang deity thing comes up. He's also got claws. He's a humanoid. He's standing there.
He's kind of gargoyle-ish, isn't he? I mean,
he is a bit gargoyle-ish, at least in visage, but he has, you know, he also has snakes coming off of his head. And he has snakes coming off of his belt, and claws on his hands and on his feet. And each culture shows him with a little more or less detail, more abstract, less abstract. But he is also clearly connected to the practice of chopping people's heads off.
Right.
So there is some people call him the decapitator deity. And separate him from other things. But that, I think, again, comes from the Amazon. We know today people are chopping people's heads off, and we know why they're doing it. It's about trapping their spirit in that head so it can then be used in that altered state, in that other world, as kind of a supernatural posse for the person who owns the head.
I watched that one. I think it was the mummy episode had the shrunken heads. Now I'm a little unclear when you're chopping off, when whoever is chopping off the head of whomever, what exactly are they trapping in the head? Some third thing, or the spirit of the person whose head they chop off?
The spirit of the person whose head they chopped off. If they just let it go, if they just kill them and walk away from the body, it becomes what a lot of Amazonian tribes call a Muisak, which is this dangerous spirit that's just kind of a wild animal loose. It transforms. It's that still that person, and that person's coming for you. Now they're a spirit, and they're going to come for you because you killed them. But if you trap them, then they have to do your bidding.
So that's the full conquering,
really. But that's how clearly the Amazonians today describe the process and why they do it. And then you go back to art on the Peruvian coast 1,000 years earlier, and all of those pieces are depicted right there. They didn't have a written language, but that meant they were communicating messages through their art. And luckily, the Moche especially left us some, you know, to date, I think we have around 200,000 pots that tell all sorts of stories painted on
and
their
all
wall.
These weaving, all this weaving also. Yeah.
Like this one right here. Here's one.
Is that an actual artifact? Is that an actual artifact?
No. I bought this for $9 from a cool guy named Angel in Trujillo, Peru.
So it's a reproduction,
right,
of a spur pot.
Right. I never take artifacts. Those are national or world patrimony, but I do love replicas.
I got that right off of your vibe immediately. And I appreciated your commentary that the one of the reasons why these very, very old cultures in South America were not so popular is because there's not gold and silver in the things. And you seem to explain archaeology as being like a alternative to looting, basically, because you got to either have looters crack it open or archaeologists who hopefully are going to turn the antiquities over to the prevailing, you know, tribe or national government there.
They are not that different, especially in methodology. They're using the same thing. In fact, most of the looters are trained by archaeologists, and most of the archaeologists are trained by looters. If we look at it from a historical perspective, you know, the early archaeologists were all just rich dilettantes who decided, you know, what I ought to do is go dig up another culture and sell it to a museum so I can keep doing it.
Yeah. Yep. Well, when I saw the Elgin marbles in the Museum of London, it really occurred to me. Those things should be sent right back to Greece.
Athens built a magnificent museum specifically to hold those marbles, and it's time for the British Museum to cough them up. Of course, if they do, they have to give up everybody else's treasures too. So they're in a bit of a bind there.
Right. So in the South American cultures, there's all of this pre-ceramic pottery, mummies. It's not the Tutankhamun thing with gold masks this big and things like this, but rather it's bona fide historical record. And it seems to go back to when the glaciers were retreating in the Northern Hemisphere. You're talking 13,000, 15,000 years ago, right?
Well, I don't think we have any mummies that early, but we have the site of, what's it called? Not Mesa Verde, Monte Verde, which is 14,800 years ago. That's on the coast of South America. In Peru, actually, might be a little south of Peru, but anyway, that's very, very old, and there were definitely people there, and that was in a bog, so we got all sorts of organic materials and learned that they were using over 200 plants from the region, so they weren't newcomers. They knew exactly what they were doing. They had lived there for a while, but of course, that just got blown out of the water by what was just found in New Mexico in White Sands National Park. They've been able to successfully now date these footprints that we knew forever by finding them in compact layers in between things that we could date. And those are coming up at 23,000 years ago. Yeah. So now we have really absolute human proof at 23,000 years ago in New Mexico. So that's a big game changer.
Yeah. I mean, I have long pondered this, and this the idea of being in the sixth creation or something. There has been, I think, civilization after civilization after civilization rising and falling and hardly leaving a trace, except somebody kind of finds an unfired clay pot left around from the year 12,000 BC, but that's not that easy to find. I think that what we're living through is just the latest iteration of things that have just happened over and over and over again. And there's no telling, you know, except your kind of holographic study of like, well, we know what happened there. We got some clue. We know they were there.
And you're right. That archaeology is a very blunt tool. When people build things out of perishable materials, they perish. And yep. We don't see them at all.
Yeah, and ultimately it's all perishable. The pyramids will not be there someday. Maybe it may take 20,000 more years, but you know, they're slowly going away, they're slowly turning to dust. I mean, that's just how it is here.
That is the passage of time. Even though the pyramids, I mean, you know, that's the I think you could have said almost any other thing and I would have been more heartily in agreement. But those dang things, I mean, you know, I love the phrase man fears time, but time fears the pyramids. They've been around forever.
Yeah, I mean, the mud and hay one made me really happy at Saqqara. Right, it's like some good formulation of mud and hay to last that. And it doesn't look like Better Homes and Gardens, but you can still tell what it is, and you can still go inside.
Well, you know, it is helpful that it's in the middle of a desert. If that same thing was built in Guatemala, it would be a puddle now.
Yeah. And there weren't glaciers there, right? I mean, or were there?
No, not in not as far as Egypt, so or Guatemala for that matter. The glacial didn't reach down that far.
No, the glaciers ended in Long Island here in North America. The terminal moraine that's what Long Island is a terminal moraine.
That's not as far as it crept down.
Yeah, and I keep wanting to hang out like right south of the glacier while it's just dumping all of its stuff right on Long Island and see what it's like to look at a mile high pile of ice dropping boulders onto the land and pebbles too.
The coast of Peru is amazing like that. There's all these cuts where it's just, you know, hundreds and hundreds of feet of nothing but cobbles this big, and you can do it was just the ice just crushing everything on its way into the ocean.
So were there glacial periods traceable from the southern hemisphere, from the southern ice cap?
Yes.
So they were previous sort of
epochs. They were reaching both directions.
Okay. I hadn't considered the southern version of the ice age in the lower southern hemisphere. So you're saying there's evidence of ice ages there too.
Yep. It just happened in our summer. No, that's a joke, but
it's an Australia joke.
It is really weird to think that we're just not used to thinking about South America living here in the Northern Hemisphere. Like simple things like their kids' school break right in the middle of it is Christmas. That's their summer break. That's so weird.
Yeah. I mean, I have enough friends from Australia that the seasonal part is a little more, natural. What to do with the astrological signs is another question. Do you reverse all of the Gaelic holidays? You put Beltane in November and Samhain in May, for example. So that debate sparks up from time to time, because our astrology is based on a whole northern mythology. So it's local to kind of Greece, England, Ireland, Nordic, and that kind of all that European stuff.
I've had to train myself to say June and December solstice instead of winter and summer, because that's not the same thing in South America.
Yeah. Yeah. And as an astrologer, I can say Cancer solstice, Capricorn solstice, which is true. It's the Sun square Tropic of Capricorn is the Capricorn solstice. Sun square Tropic of Cancer is the Cancer solstice.
Ah, that's a nice.
Right. I mean, that's where the names come from. Right. I mean, it's a tropical zodiac, and it's based on the sun's alignment to the tropics, including the equator.
right? At 23 and a half degrees north and 23 and a half degrees south. That's a, you know, that's something I pay attention to because I think the Maya did and the Khmer culture did, the two really big civilizations that are in the tropics. It's funny that, you know, people think of Egypt as tropics, but it's not. I mean, all except the very southern bit of the Egyptian Empire was north of 23 and a half. So was most of what, all of the Roman world, all of the Greek world, about half of India. So they, right. They were outside the tropics, which means they didn't have a zenith passage sun, which is something I'm always looking for evidence that they understood. Cause that's a fun one when you're, you know, you, as an astrology person, you know, where the sun is very important. And all around the world, everybody has solstice. Everybody has equinox on the same day, but zenith passage changes on your latitude. Now Chichen Itza's day when the sun is directly over their head at noon is different than the day that Palenque has. And the sure. Maya were talking about it. They were talking about, hey, when's your zenith? When's my zenith? And let's communicate back and forth about it, which is fascinating when you're looking at this, at when you're looking at how everything moves and all of a sudden you realize, oh my God, is the sun different where you are? That's a trip. And that's something that they focused on. And so did the Khmer.
It's different in many, different ways. I mean, I was once sitting in a plaza in The Hague, and in that whole part of the world, the sun is different. There's a sun filter over Netherlands and Belgium that lent itself to certain forms of lighting that I've never seen this kind of light anywhere. I'm a photographer also, so I'm looking at the light everywhere, and I was sitting in a plaza. It was very strange. It was a round plaza in The Hague, very, very old plaza. I was with a friend. We had just gotten some fantastic pot from one of the lovely places you can get that. We smoked a little, and we're sitting there in this utterly silent plaza, and it's evening, and the light is striking the buildings in a certain way. And I said, okay, now I'm drawing a blank on the name of the painter, the most famous Dutch painter. Was he Dutch? Rembrandt. I said, Rembrandt. Was Rembrandt Dutch? Uh-huh. Because the light looked exactly like Rembrandt was painting it. And I wish I still had my apartment in Belgium for the light coming in the window. So the light, the sun is different. It is different based on a million different factors. It's a natural phenomenon. So they had local solstices called zenith celebrations, like zeniths there and then 500 miles away there.
Zenith passage happens only in the tropics, and it changes from day to day. It's like it will move about 20 miles every day. It'll go, you know, you'll hit your equinox.
Yep.
You know, so you have equinox here and you have a solstice here, the June solstice, the summer solstice. And the sun moves on the horizon every day, and it finally hits June solstice.
And it seems to stop for a couple of days.
That day at 23 and a half degrees, that day is the day that the sun is directly over your head. So at exactly that line, the sun will go directly over your head at 23 and a half degrees north. But then as you go south, every day for each latitude is a time. Each one of them will have their own day of zenith passage. So like Palenque's is coming back down from solstice towards equinox. Palenque's is August 7th, but Chichen Itza's is July 17th, I think. So they're different. And they would talk about it to each other. We know that they were emulating each other's zenith passages. There's an idea that the calendar was created at exactly 15.8 degrees latitude because that day, that at that latitude, zenith passage perfectly breaks up the calendar into 260 days and 105 days. from one zenith to the next zenith is 105 days, leaving you 260 days. So it's like a perfect place where the sun splits out the sacred calendar from the solar calendar.
The two zeniths being the sun's on the way south after the northern solstice and on the way north after the southern solstice. And those two zeniths are separated by 105 days.
Yes, I'd say the equinox to the north solstice and then the north solstice back to equinox. They go back and forth there because right at 0 degrees, the day of zenith passage is equinox. And it'll only happen one day. They're at zero, zenith passage only happens one day a year. I guess maybe twice. But at 23 and a half degrees, that's at solstice at that angle, it's at that zenith passage.
Right. Yeah. So all the people doing this were more tuned into the natural world than our society is.
Absolutely. I mean, you,
they were involved.
You're probably an exception, but yes, our society.
I mean, I do my best and sure, you know, I could slip into your life work easily. If I just, it's amazing. I mean, you're on in the physical sense, I've explored it somewhat physically, mostly conceptually. And I'm about to go excavating some rocks on my friend's backyard since I can get there and I can get a little shovel and a brush.
We should talk about that. I'll give you a little bit of hints how to do it in a way that you can record it.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. I cannot want a better instructor there. One question I've had for you is in all of your exploration around these areas and looking into things and talking to people, have you ever paused and said, there's something off world going on? Not a parallel dimension like Mr. Fang deity, but like any evidence. Like, for example, were there really F-15 like airplanes found in South America in as artifacts? That's complete hokum.
I mean, you know, it's art history. It's interpretation of what you see. I think I know what you're talking about. They're the Muisak gold pieces that were found outside of Bogota. And some of them do look like little airplanes, but they're bugs.
They're not bugs, airplanes. But I've seen I haven't read, but seen that they tested them aerodynamically and they got a good result. That there is, they understood aerodynamics, but
I don't know about that study at all, but I think bugs are also aerodynamic.
Some of them pretty damn good at flying.
I've seen those pieces you're talking about, and they are like dragonflies or butterflies. They're gold images of bugs.
That's not what I'm talking about. So let me see if I can dig that out sometime. These were more shaped like F-15 aircraft than like bugs.
Well, I'd be happy to take a look.
Have you ever paused and said, maybe there's some crossover here? Have you ever seen a single thing that has given you a hint that maybe there's another we've been visited?
I am open to the possibility, but no, not in my experience have I ever thought that. And I guess, you know, I'm somewhat cautious in that because there is there is a compunction of some to misuse that.
Yes.
To
turn to the next 2012.
Explain how weird little brown people could do these things. That, you know, somehow it had to be aliens. It had to be Atlantis. You know, how could these impoverished savages do this sort of thing? That gets used as a cudgel against some of these cultures. So I have a pushback in general that I suspect the agenda of certain people, not in an evil, snidely whiplash way, but in the kind of casual racism that everybody doesn't know they're doing. There's all too often an urge to explain the achievements of basically brown cultures.
How do you think they moved stones that big that we can't even move today, though? That's what amazes me, that some of these stones or even our own best construction equipment couldn't even move them.
You know, it's not undoable. I mean, I think that our construction equipment can move big things now, but even people can do it. I mean, there's, you know, some of it is still mystery, which I love. But, you know, we have shown ways that people can use log rollers, or here's one you'd love to see. Look up a guy named Wally Wallington. I forget. He's all over YouTube. Wally Wallington. He's a retired construction guy who's built Stonehenge in his backyard in Wisconsin by himself. And it's amazing. And he just uses these really simple concepts. His core concept is two little balls under a big stone can swivel it and move it back and forth. And he does it all. It's called like Forgotten Technologies or something, but he's got a whole bunch of videos of him step by step building Stonehenge himself, just him.
Actual size or a replica?
Size. His wife is like pissed off that he spent their entire retirement on cement. But he builds these huge things out of cement, and then he moves them big distances, and then he hoists them up. It's so funny. He's just a regular old construction guy. I mean, he's not some kind of brilliant scientist. When he finally builds it, his son-in-laws are like, hey, what are we going to call it? Let's call it Wallyhenge. No, let's call it Stonehenge Reloaded. They're just a bunch of yahoos, but the guy has figured it out. And if he could do it, it's kind of amazing.
Right. Yes. Yeah, and Stonehenge is impressive.
Wally. You're welcome, Wally. I said, when I saw that stuff, I was like, I'm sending Wally my money. He needs more cement.
Excellent. Another lingering question here while I'm in the Ask Me Anything session. Trading seafood. Now, how do they keep it fresh? Now, you've said several times, the shells, I understand, right? You've got the Indians in Long Island trading shells for the Indians in upstate. But how do they get the fish? How do they keep the fish fresh for long enough to get it? There was no cold chain, ice packs.
There's a couple of different things. By the time we get to the Inca, they have that amazing runner system, and they could actually, with the chaskis, the runners that would run their guts out for about 20 kilometers to the next way station where another guy would be waiting and run. The Inca, they say at least, could actually up in the mountains in Cusco say, I'd like an ocean fish for dinner, and begin the chain of runners. And by dinner time, somebody had run back up the Andes with a fish. And now it involved, you know, 1,000 guys running their guts out for 20 kilometers at a time, but he could get it there that fast. That's how efficient the Inca Chaski runner system was and across their Inca roads. But if we dispense with fresh and just transporting and trading fish, the Inca are actually, and probably before the Inca, are responsible for the invention of how to create jerky. They would create fish jerky. And actually our word jerky is a Quechua word. It's chirky. And we call it jerky, but they perfected a way to dry out fish and then transport it and keep it for much longer. My wife was like, shut up, Cliff Clavin. That's not true. And she looked it up and it was true. She hates it when I have weird little factoids like that, but it's true. They were able to, they developed a technique to dry it. They also did this weird thing with potatoes in the same way that they could keep forever.
Preservation had not occurred to me.
Yeah. They are the inventors of jerky. Next time you're enjoying a piece of jerky, thank the Inca.
Well, and I was also in my email to you last night lamenting how few words, indigenous words from the Americas have gotten into indigenous language. We could probably do an interesting article on indigenous words that have made it into the dictionary.
There are a good bit of them. You know, there's funny little words you wouldn't expect. One example, the Maya gave us the word shark. The Maya word is shock. X-O-K. The Spanish word is tiburón. That's not anywhere near there. When we call that creature a shark, we're actually saying a Maya word.
Huh. I wonder what Doug has to say about that. Etymology of shark.
Hurricane as well. The Maya have a deity named Hurucan, who's the deity of these high winds, and that's where we get the word hurricane.
There, an old theory, the English word is from a Mayan word, XOC, Jacques, which meant shark. Northern Europeans seem to not have been familiar with the larger sort of sharks before voyages to the tropics began. A slightly earlier name for it in English was tiburon. Huh. From Spanish, ooh, tiburon, 1530s, 1520s.
Am I being live validated by Google?
No. My memory is not fully performing today, but the editor of Etymology Online Dictionary is fabulous. I've corresponded with him many times and had my own personal etymology lessons, and he basically devotes himself to an etymology dictionary 24/7 and wrote the entire thing. It's really one of the best things on the entire internet.
That is so fun.
Etymology Online Dictionary. And the history of them, and it's kind of an archaeology, really. It's an archaeology of language, of dusting it off and like tracking the uses, like when the first time bachelor party was used, like when bachelor goes back to like 1401, but like bachelor party is like 1876.
It's so fascinating. The entymology of these words. I love it. And so I'm glad that he shares my opinion about.
So sharks. Doug says Mayan word, an old theory. He calls it an old theory, but he's not disparaging of it at all. And certainly Jacques sounds a lot more like shark than
shock
than
tiburon.
That's
the in Mesoamerican languages, an X is an SH sound. And shock. The Aztecs word for obsidian was XIT. I'll let you sound that out in your head.
Zeet.
Shit.
Oh. Right up. One last thought. And it involves doing, local archaeology, right? Because not everyone can get to Guatemala, and I reckon, because I'm not taking any COVID injections, it's going to be a while before I can get down there. But I'm fortunate to live in an area where there's interesting stuff, and I think that we can all learn a lot from not walking past things so quickly, particularly in the country. But I mean, for example, in Paris, my favorite place in all of Paris was the archaeological crypt. It's right at the end of the Notre Dame Plaza. There's like face of Notre Dame, and then there's a big plaza about the size of a football field. And at the end of that, it looks like a metro station. But when you go down there, you find out that they've excavated underneath the plaza a Roman
catacombs.
Well, it's called the Archaeological Crypt of Paris, and it's a Roman neighborhood. It's not catacombs. It's storefronts, hypocaust heating systems. Caves from the Seine. The Seine moved, apparently. And I used to love to go down there. And it was...
Gosh, I walked right over that and didn't even know it.
Yeah. And so it's... I went down there as many times as I could. My press pass saved me €3 every time I went down there. And from studying about what these rock walls may be, I'm thinking there's a whole universe of local archaeology that people can do.
Oh, there is. I mean, ancient history in North America is everywhere, and people don't realize it. They do walk right past it every day. Almost every part of the country you be in, save a couple of little places like, the Great Plains, things like that. But in your neck of the woods, I mean, geez, there was, literally thousands and thousands of years of culture before Europeans ever showed up. And, Europeans count as culture too. Historic archaeology is still awesome and cool and worth preserving. Mm-hmm. And people don't realize too that almost every county has its own historical society and an archaeology society, and they invite people to come in and be volunteers for projects all the time. You know, archaeology doesn't make any money. We don't make guns or butter, so we're always dependent on interested volunteers. Yep. Now, one caution I would say, though, you know, when it's your land, it's your land. You get to do what you want to do with it. But archaeology is not a repeatable experiment. So, mm-hmm. you know, whoever does it, what they record and who they share it with, that's what the rest of humanity gets. So it's not a repeatable experiment. If you're going to do it, you know, at least Google some archaeological forms and take some photos, because that what you do there will be what the rest of humanity into the future knows about whatever it is.
Yep.
And if you find something important, heck, you should share it with the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I'm very interested in pursuing Matt. I believe Matt Bua's long investigation into these stone walls in New England, 252,000 miles of them, according to a USDA survey, only in New England, only in the northeastern states. 252,000 miles.
I would love to know what you find out about it. You know, you reminded me of this, and I looked a little bit into it in the last couple of days, and I'm fascinated to hear what you find out about it. It seems like most people think it's somehow European after initial contact. It may or may not be. I'm kind of fascinated how similar it looks to Irish stuff, that it's like the Celtic and after Celtic, the kings of Ireland were still really very much Gaelic at first contact in the Americas. My running theory at the moment is that it may well have been people who wanted to remain Gaelic and were pressured by England and came over in boats and then just went north where nobody would bother them and built the same sort of thing they were building in Ireland. I've been in a lot of the Ireland sites, and the dolmens are there. Things that look reminiscently like passage tombs are there in New England. Mm-hmm. And those long stone walls, they were building similar things all over like County Mayo. If you look at some stuff from County Mayo, the constructions are strangely similar. That's my bet. But kind of like pyramids, archaeology. You never know.
The interesting part is, and we really, you know, we need to use the method here, but the amount of time it would take to construct these, said to be 100 years, there were not very many people here in 1750.
Well,
and so someone did the calculation of how long it would take and to construct 252,000 miles of this, and it would be impossible based on a time calculation, assuming full-time activity of every man, woman, and child 9 months a year, there still wouldn't have been enough time. So that's what got my attention. But he's saying that there may be canal systems below them that they may conceal things, and so they need to be excavated, I think.
Every human that builds things like that drops trash and things from their life underneath it, and it's in a sealed context. That's what we archaeologists do. You know, when we want to figure out how old a building is, we dig under it and look for the wrappers and trash the guys that built it dumped in there, and that's what tells you.
Yes, you find the Snickers wrapper from 5000 BC with the copyright on it.
That's right.
And interestingly, the same piece of land was a major kind of hippie colony for many, many years, because it was like a dude ranch where the hippies hung out. And so I've always thought those are the trash pits to dig up. I want to see, you know, I want to find some Coke bottles and that, you know, pocket knives from that era. For years, I had a comb that I found after one of the hurricanes. That's not it, but it was similar because the hurricane churned up the land. I found a subway token from the 70s there because it just moved everything around, including very, very large rocks, like 10-ton rocks removed by one of the hurricanes, by the cascade of water. I mean, I know that rock was that thing was there, and it's not there anymore. And it's somewhere else. It's moved. It shifted 20 feet. Or, but there's a lot of. What's that?
The power of nature is just so amazing when you see it move multi-ton stones like that.
Yeah. And it's amazing there's anything left after all of these glaciers and retreats and hurricanes and storms and the rising and falling of seas. It's amazing there's anything left for you to go looking at to figure out. It's amazing there's one mummy left after all of this, but there are. So,
yeah, it's the fun of archaeology.
Yep. Good. Ed, genuinely a pleasure. So, again, Ed has this wonderful Mayan calendar with beautiful photos and the day counts in it. And one to the next 20 people who give any monthly donation, that you have put, we'll put the link up, and then we will also, I'm going to do what I can to get the word out about this publication of yours.
Thank you. I appreciate it. You know, I do it mostly for love. I just, it's a very small little business, but I'm always happy to share it with people, especially your audience, who's so interested in looking at time in different ways. I feel like there are illegitimate sources of Maya wisdom out there, and I, as sincerely as I can, am just communicating what I know from real Maya people.
Yeah, and you're placing something in a contemporary context that's actually current, rather than, say, for example, a history book about it. It's a useful object. It's a useful thing.
Yeah, and we are keeping it alive, which, you know, cultural diversity is under assault these days. This is my little part.
Yes, good. All right. So till next time, I guess I'll be seeing you in like episode 26 of the South America series.
Well, I'll see you then.
Wonderful. And that, by the way, is in Great Courses. Just type in Ed Barnhart. And it's I highly recommend Great Courses.
They've got a new thing that they've turned into. They've turned into something called Wonderum, and it's one of those channels you can get on your Roku box or however you get those. Like if you get Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and all those as a channel, now there's one called Wonderum where you can see their entire huge corpus for a monthly fee, just like all those other little channels.
Yeah, and it's really worth it now that you have to go to Harvard on Zoom for $75,000 a year. This is a lot cheaper than going to Harvard on Zoom for $75,000 a year. It's like $15 a month. And since killing my commercial television, after I realized it not only had no actual information value, but it lost all of its kind of archaeology value also, I killed that and like, this is amazing.
They definitely know their stuff. They hire great people. And I can tell you by going through the process, they have a very rigorous system of verifying everything that comes out. I have never been so scrutinized and judged in my entire life. Everything I say on those courses is vetted by a whole team of people who try to prove me wrong at every turn.
That is interesting. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that because I've learned a lot from them and continue to do so. All right. Once again, thank you very much. We'll link your podcast. We'll link Mayan-calendar.com and click on that donate to Chiron Return Planet Waves FM. And you will have one of Ed's calendars in your hands in probably in about 2 weeks because we've got to order them today. I'll call you in a second when we're off of the Zoom call and give you a card number. And I'm thrilled to know you and that you're doing the work that you're doing and that you're an accessible, down-to-earth guy. It's a great pleasure. Hearts open, hats off.
Fun. Invite me again sometime. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Good. I'll have other questions once I formulate them and maybe more specific topics or even specific areas or regions or what you're doing next or whatever, including expeditions. If you're still leading them, happy to pitch those too.
Your community.
Good.
Well, it was a pleasure. Fun to talk to you.
Ed, thank you.
Thank you.
Love. Bye for now.
Adios.